Well, this week we find ourselves in Nehemiah 6 and 7, primarily in chapter 6. And if you open to Nehemiah chapter 6, it says, "Now when Sanballat," and just stop right there. Sanballat is the villain of Nehemiah. He's the primary villain. He's the ringleader of the other villains. And he has just been a total pain throughout this book. But good news, after this week, we don't hear about him anymore. He is done. He's kaput. He is finished. He shuts his mouth, and his attacks are totally defeated. So the question to you is, what happens in these two chapters that finally shuts him up? What is the thing in these two chapters that finally puts a finish to him? So watch for that. See if you can figure out. Because Sanballat is a picture of the enemy in our own lives and the tactics he uses against us. So let's read the first couple of verses here. "Now when Sanballat and Tobiah and Geshem the Arab and the rest of our enemies heard that I had built the wall and that there was no breach left in it, although up to that time I had not set up the doors and the gates." Now the wall is pretty useless without some gates. And gates can't exist without a wall. And so at this point, we've got the wall done, the 10 gates are there, but the doors have not been hung yet. And so at this point, Sanballat, he makes his next attack. Now, let's have a little review of Sanballat's rap sheet. These are the things that he has done so far throughout the book. Back in chapter 2, verse 10, it expresses how displeased he was that Nehemiah came to help Israel at all. He did not want Israel helped. And the moment you or I try to help someone, to help God's people, to serve God by serving his people, there's no other way to serve him than that, the enemy becomes very displeased. We are right away added to his hit list. And then he mocked the work. People with little courage, all it takes is some mockery. It takes some disparaging speech, takes a little to depress the emotions a bit, and they're done. But he came to mock the work, but that didn't stop Nehemiah. And then last week we looked at how in chapter 4, verse 1, they got angry, and then they became extremely angry and were threatening. And the next thing is he plotted to fight and cause confusion. They were actually going to go on a physical attack. That didn't work. And so here in chapter 6, verses 1 and 2, it says there in verse 2, "Sanballat and Geshem sent to me saying, 'Come, let's meet together at Hakfarim in the plain of Ono.'" In other words, let's sit down and talk. Now this is where so many of us, we allow the enemy to win some ground. He uses somebody to persecute, everything. Then finally say, let's get together and talk. We think, oh, good, they're going to see reason now. Now there's going to be peace. And maybe in some cases there will be. But probably not. Because the next thing they'll do is they will feign friendship to wheedle their way into your thoughts and minds and bring destruction from within. So what does Nehemiah say? "Come, let us meet together at Hakfarim in the plain of Ono." But they intended to do me harm. The word there is ra'ah. They intended to do me evil. So the next thing they do is in verses 6 to 8, which we'll look at in a moment. They send around some letters with lying rumors. There are 7 lies contained in this letter. And then later in this chapter, we see him hiring a false prophet. Hiring a false prophet. So let's resort to religion. We can't bring him down through verbal attacks, maybe some physical attacks, by trying to make friends with them and bring them down from the inside. Let's haul in religion. Let's do something in God's name. Let's bring God in and try to bring him down that way. And we're going to talk about prophets in a little bit of detail today, because after all, the name of this teaching is Prophets of Fear. Prophets of Fear. So let's continue on and see what happens. So verse 3. "By the way, He wanted to meet an Ono, but Nehemiah said, "Oh no." Ono is kind of an interesting word because the last letter, that vav at the end, makes it a possessive. So these first three letters here, Aleph, Vav, Nun, when you pronounce them avain, it means wickedness or iniquity. So we can translate the word Ono as his wickedness, his iniquity. You know, you'd think somebody like Sanballat would pick a place with a better name, because the name kind of gives it away. But then we find this word avain, those first three letters. A couple examples, Psalm 5:5, the boastful shall not stand before your eyes. You hate all who do avain, wickedness or iniquity. And Psalm 6:9 in the English translation, or the Jewish Bible, is verse 8. Depart from me, all you who do avain, for the Lord, or Adonai, has heard the voice of my weeping. So you see this word often, but this is where the enemy wants to meet with us to talk. We always turn out meeting him on his ground, and it'll always be a place of wickedness and iniquity. So, verse 3. And I sent messengers to them, saying, I am doing a great work, and I cannot come down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and come down to you? And they sent to me four times in this way, and I answered them in the same manner, in the same way Sanballat, for the fifth time, sent his servant to me with an open letter in his hand. Notice how persistent he is. He just keeps aggravating Nehemiah with this. And this is the enemy's tactic. When I was a teenager, I read C.S. Lewis's science fiction trilogy. And in the second book, which is called Not Out of the Silent Planet. What is the second book? It just went right out of my head. Anyways, the second book, the book is kind of a parable, an allegory. And in this book, Ransom, who's the main character, goes to a planet which is like Earth at the time of the Garden of Eden. And there's an Adam figure and an Eve figure. And the villain comes in a spaceship along with Ransom, and he comes to tempt this Eve figure into sin. And you hear the dialogue and the arguments he has with her, why she should disobey her creator. And Ransom is there to encourage her to obey the creator. It's a great book. It's a brilliant book. And one of the parts that just stood out to me, because C.S. Lewis had such a handle on how the enemy is so petulant and just so infantile sometimes in his attacks. And he says at night, this bad guy would be over here and Ransom would be trying to sleep, and the villain, the one who's possessed by the spirit of Satan himself, all night long he'd go, Ransom, Ransom, Ransom. And Ransom would say, what? And he'd say, nothing. And then, Ransom, Ransom, Ransom. What? Nothing. This is going all night long. It was maddening. You know, the enemy works the same way. It's like Chinese water torches. Drip, 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 drip. That's just how petty our enemy truly is. He's desperate. Our enemy is truly desperate, as we're going to see. So verse 6. In this letter he sent, it was written, it is reported among the nations, and Geshem also says it, he's the Arab, that you and the Jews intend to rebel. That is why you are building the wall. And according to those reports, you wish to become their king. And you have also set up prophets to proclaim concerning you in Jerusalem. There is a king in Judah. And now the king, Darius, back in Persia, will hear of these reports. So now come, let's counsel together, let's do lunch. Then I sent to them, saying, no such things as you say have been done, for you are inventing them out of your own mind. For they all wanted to frighten us, thinking their hands will drop from the work, and it will not be done. So here are the lies in the letter. The email I sent out, I asked you if you could identify the lies. is reported among the nations. No, it wasn't. You and the Jews intend to rebel. No, they didn't. This is why you're building the wall. No, it isn't. You want to become the king. No, I don't. You have hired your own prophets. No, I haven't. The king, referring to Darius, will hear about this. And I'm thinking, Nehemiah's thinking, I hope he does. Because Darius, I was his cupbearer for years and years. His wife is Esther. Or his mother, I'm sorry, his mother is Esther. She knows what we're doing. She helped inspire him to send us back to rebuild the temple and rebuild the wall. Yeah, you go ahead and tell him what you're thinking. Let's get together and talk. And Nehemiah, of course, would have none of that nonsense. And what was the reason for this letter? It says, for they all wanted to frighten us, thinking their hands will drop from the work and it will not be done, because Sanballat knew that fear produces weakness. Show me a weak person, I'll show you a fearful one. Fear produces weakness. It also produces anger. Show me an angry person, I'll show you a fearful one. And you know, during these times of the COVID, I know it's been a very divisive thing among people. Some people treat it like it's nothing, like there is no illness out there. Well, there is an illness. But guess what? There are a lot of other illnesses out there too, and always have been, always will be. And others are at the other extreme where they're terrified. I was reading some notices by some people in our neighborhood, and they are terrified to leave their house. They still have not left the house in how many months? Now, I'm not against caution. Caution's a good thing. But fear? Mm-mm. The moment you become afraid, you become weak. The moment you become afraid, you've made COVID your God instead of God. At least you're starting to rob his glory. It's like this. Let's say you have to go downtown to an office appointment or whatever. You go downtown and there's traffic shooting past on the street, but you're on the sidewalk. So while you're walking on the sidewalk, what do? You exercise caution, especially when you're crossing the street. That's how we're to live in the age of COVID. You go about your business, you live your life, you exercise caution. But a person says, I'm not going downtown, I'm scared to death, a car is going to shoot off the road up on the sidewalk and run me down. Now that's insane. It could happen. But to allow that fear to paralyze you, that's not what we as believers do. We believers are in the business of believing. We believe in God. We trust in him. There always have been illnesses, always will be. And so, exercise caution. Got it. All for it. But to let it petrify you, to terrorize you, because then it weakens you. And here's another thing you have to realize. The enemy is afraid of you up until you become afraid of him. Let's face it, our enemy is a serpent. He is a snake. You, on the other hand, have a sword. You have an armor. You have shoes. You have a shield. Who's got the advantage in this fight? You or the enemy? You have every advantage. He's scared to death of you. And it says he'll flee from those who resist him. All you got to do is just resist him and he'll run away. He is scared of you. And if you are a soldier of light and he is the prince of darkness, guess what? As you are light in this world, you take his territory away from him and he has no ground to stand. He is fearful of you. But that's one of his best kept secrets. That's one of the things he does not want you to know. He wants you to be afraid of him. And when you become afraid of him, now he's got control. Because the only weapon he has is the mouth. And to put in the poison of falsehoods and lies. And the moment you believe a lie to that degree, you've been made weaker and you've given him some control in your life. Truth, on the other hand, makes you free. Truth makes you a soldier. And you can wield the sword of the Spirit, which is the word of truth. And he is flying out of there as fast as he can. You know, in Revelation, It talks about a great war in heaven that's coming. Now, God doesn't fight this war. That wouldn't be fair. Michael and the angels fight against the enemy. And this is how they defeat him. It says they overcame him, overcame Satan, because of the blood of the Lamb. In other words, the battle's really already been fought. God has done this part. He's won the victory for us. He's just sent us in to do the cleanup. By the word of their testimony. What's the word of the testimony? That would be truth. And they did not love their own life, even when faced with death. They love God more than anything in the world. The biggest threat the enemy can hold over us is that we're going to die. Well, it's like, duh, I knew that already. So you can't frighten me with it. And the only thing about death that I'm afraid of is that my death would be wasted. I want to die with my boots on. I want to die doing what God wants me to do. I don't want to die holed up somewhere because I got afraid and ran. Everybody dies. And, you know, in these, I believe we're in the end times. I was in a conversation with a lady from out of state, and we were talking about end times. And somehow the subject came around to why everybody has, for so many years, talks about end time prophecy, and it just becomes their total focus of their lives. And I believe it's because these people, to a great degree, are afraid to die, and they hope that the Messiah will return before then so they can sidestep death. And I told her, but I said, if we're not prepared to die, we're not prepared to meet him. If you're not prepared to die now, you're not prepared to meet him if he comes now. And only people prepared to die, to step out of this life into a better one, to leave the shell behind and look forward to resurrection. If you're not prepared to die, you're certainly not prepared to meet Messiah when he arrives. You understand? So I shared with the lady, I said, I'm planning to die. Now, if Yeshua comes back, that's fantastic, but I'm preparing to die. Because so far, for the last 2,000 years, all the people who are looking forward to his return all died. Who am I to think I get to skip that? So I'm just going to plan to die. If he comes, I'm prepared for that as well. That'd be great. I believe he is coming. I think he's coming soon. But I'm not getting any younger either. So I just challenge you. Defeat fear. The grave's been conquered. Yeshua says, yeah, I went and did that. It's no big deal. It's a door. I've taken away the fear of death, the sting of death, the victory of death. So I've been there, done that. Come on through the door when it's time. We shouldn't fear death anymore. We fear stepping through that door right there to go to another part. Well, anyways, I'm starting to preach, so I'm going to get away from that. Let's pick it up. Now, in verse 9, translations don't know quite how to handle this last part. It says this, for they all wanted to frighten us, thinking, their hands will drop from the work, and it will not be done. But now, O God, strengthen my hands. Now, that's how most people translate that last little phrase. But the words, O God, are not there. Translators assume that Nehemiah here is talking to God, so to help us understand that, they put the words, O God. But now, O God, or O Lord, or just the word God, does your translation have that? Probably most all of them do, right? You have to nod your heads. I can't see you smile. They just, okay, yes? Okay, just cross that out. The word, O God, is not there in the Hebrew at all. In fact, the Jewish translators believe that Nehemiah is talking to Sanballat, and that it should be translated this way, okay? For they all wanted to frighten us, thinking their hands will drop from the work and it will not be done. But now you want to strengthen my hand? Now you're wanting to help me? You get it? So he's saying, you've been resisting me all this time and now you want me to come and sit with you? You want to help me out? You want to talk and help get rid of these rumors that you guys started? So whichever way it's supposed to be translated, I don't know. But those are two possibilities. And so I just want to make you aware of that. And then it goes on, verse 10. Now when I went into the house of Shemaiah, now Shemaiah was a prophet, the son of Deliah, son of Mehetabel, who was confined to his home, he said, let's meet together in the house of God. Now do you see a problem there? Why did he want to meet in the house of God? Let's go on, see. Within the temple, let us close the doors of the temple, for they are coming to kill you. They are coming to kill you by night. What Shemaiah is doing is this. He's saying, you built the wall, you built the gates, but there are no doors on the gates. And I've had a word from the Lord that these enemies are coming to kill you at night. So I tell you what, let's go into the temple. It's got doors on it. We can go in and close the doors. You'll be safe. But what is Nehemiah's response to this? Look what he says. But I said, should a man such as I run away? I'm the shepherd of this flock. When danger comes, does the shepherd run and hide? God's called me to be a leader. Do leaders run and hide when there's a threat? Is this the example I want to set to the people? And then the next thing he says is this. And who am I that I could go into the temple and live? He says, I'm not a priest. And he knew the Torah, because in Numbers 3:10 it says, so you, Moses, shall appoint Aaron and his sons that they may keep their priesthood. But the layman who comes near shall be put to death. He's thinking, if I go into the temple, I deserve to die. I am not a priest. Nehemiah was from the tribe of Judah, not from the tribe of Levi. He was not a descendant of Aaron. So he knew the Torah. I can't go in there. And he also knew who he was. If you have those two pieces of knowledge in your own life, who you are and what the commandments say, the enemy really can't do much of anything to you. You get up each morning, put on that helmet of salvation. What's the helmet? Protects the mind. And why is it called the helmet of salvation instead of the helmet of Bible knowledge? It's called the helmet of salvation because the first thing you do when you get up, you encase your brain in the fact, I have been saved by the blood of Yeshua, my Messiah. I have been adopted into the family of God. I'm not my own. I've been bought with a price. I belong to him. I am his son, his daughter. You got your head right. You know who you are. And it's by looking at the helmets in the distance you can tell who's the enemy, because they would have different shaped helmets and colors or whatever. And so it's like, I know who I am, and I want the world to know who I am, and I want the enemy to know who I am, and that I know who I am. You need to know who you are and to know that God is your God. He is your king and he's your protector. All right? You hold that on. Nothing's going to get through there that's going to upset your peace and rob you of your peace. Next thing you need to know are what are God's commandments. You need to know his word. Nehemiah knew the Torah. And so he wasn't going to misstep. He wasn't going to violate the word of God. Because when you do that, it's called sin. And when you sin, you put some chinks in your armor. Now the enemy has a way to get in. Know who you are and know God's will. Know his word. Right? Two important pieces of knowledge we all need to have. And then let's continue on. So I remember verse 12, and I understood and saw that God had not sent him, had not sent Shemaiah, but he had pronounced the prophecy against me because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. How do you like that? They hired a prophet to speak a lie. For in this purpose he was hired, that I should be afraid and act in this way and sin. Go into the temple, that's sin. And so they could give me a bad name in order to taunt me. Now he's praying. He says, remember Tobiah and Sanballat, O my God, according to these things that they did, and also the prophet Noadiah and the rest of the prophets who wanted to make me afraid. Notice how many times he says, make me afraid. It's back in verse 8. I'm sorry, verse 9, for they all wanted to frighten me. And then it's here in verse 13. They hired him so that I should be afraid. And then verse 14 ends, that this prophet, they wanted to make me afraid. And then the last verse of the chapter, and Tobias sent letters to make me afraid. All of the enemy's efforts are focused on making you afraid. Why? Because the enemy's afraid of you until you become afraid of him. You understand that? All of the enemy's tactics are aimed at you to make you afraid. You think, well, listen, aren't his tactics there to make me sin? Yeah, because the wicked flee when no one's chasing them. The righteous are bold as lions. But the enemy can get you to sin and become a habitual sinner and to violate his Torah and become a wicked person. You're going to be running away when nobody's even chasing you. But all of his tactics are to make you fearful. Because fear makes you weak. Fear makes you angry. Fear makes you no threat to him. None. Zero. No, and John F. Kennedy said, we have nothing to fear but fear itself. You know, there's a lot of truth in that. Except we shouldn't even fear fear. We should only fear God. And like I always say, anything you fear other than him, you've made into a god, into an idol, because you're giving to it what belongs only to God. Don't give your fear to anything else except him. He's the only one we are to fear. And fear of God is the beginning of wisdom. A fearful person cannot be a wise person. Okay? So how do you defeat fear? Truth. Truth makes you free. Fear makes you a slave, makes you weak, makes you chained up. But truth sets you free. And you'll know the truth if you're a disciple. As Yeshua said, I think it's in John 8, but it says, if you continue in my word, then you're my disciples indeed. And you shall know the truth, and the truth will make you free. Okay? It's not a complicated thing. It's a very black and white scripture. But so many times we think, the enemy wants to deceive us, think, oh, you're afraid? Oh, you're wise to be afraid. You should be afraid. That's a good thing to be afraid. And no, it isn't. Cautious, yes. Only a fool doesn't exercise caution. But fear, only someone the enemy's got wrapped around his finger, someone who doesn't know truth, those are the people who are fearful. Choose to be brave. True to be courageous. You say, well, I might die. Well, I got news for you. You're going to die. So you might as well die brave as to die fearful. I'm going to do something. I didn't plan to do it this way, but I am actually going to jump down to way down here to the end. And let's talk about false prophets for a little bit, because I have a feeling you might be distracted by this whole thing about hiring a prophet to tell a lie. And I think we have a lot of false notions about prophets. So I have a series of scriptures. We're not going to take a lot of time. But I have a passage of scripture. I encourage you to go back and read the context of that scripture. And then I have a little summary at the end of each one. So let's go through these quickly. 1 Kings 13:18, just a little background. God sends a prophet to go deliver a message for him. And he says, then after you've delivered that message, do not stop on the way back home. Don't stop to eat, don't stop to drink, don't stop to rest, don't stop to do anything, but make your way back home. Don't stop for anybody. But then a prophet here, another prophet hears about this and says, I want to talk to this guy that God sent. Here's what this other prophet says. He said to him, I also am a prophet like you, and an angel spoke to me by the word of Adonai, saying, bring him back with you to your house, that he may eat bread and drink water. But he lied to him. The lesson here is that a prophet can lie, same as anybody. Does that shock you? It should. It is kind of shocking. But this is the truth. A prophet can lie. Jeremiah 14:14, then Adonai said to me, the prophets are prophesying falsehood in my name. He didn't say false prophets are prophesying falsehood. He didn't say pretend prophets. He says these are prophets. and they're prophesying falsehood in my name. I have neither sent them, nor commanded them, nor spoken to them. They are prophesying to you a false vision, divination, something they derive somehow or other, futility, and this last one is what gets me, the deception of their own minds. And the word for minds are hearts. Heart and mind are used pretty much interchangeably in the scriptures. Deception of their own minds. Now, these prophets probably thought they really were speaking for God, but their hearts had deceived them. So the question we have to ask, what is the prophet's source of prophecy? Because there are a lot of things here. False vision, divination, just emptiness, just vanity. They're wanting to be noticed, so they prophesy things so people will pay attention to them. Or their hearts have deceived them. Jeremiah 23:16, and then I skip to 21 and 22. Thus says Adonai of hosts, do not listen to the words of the prophets who are prophesying to you. They are leading you into futility. They speak a vision of their own imagination. It's actually the word heart again. Not from the mouth of Adonai. I did not send these prophets, but they ran. I did not speak to them, but they're prophesying. But if they had stood to my counsel, then they would have announced my words to my people and would have turned them back from their evil way and from the evil of their deeds. And the moral of this is prophets like to prophesy. Therein lies the danger. Prophets like to prophesy. And so they have a tendency to prophesy even when there's nothing God's saying right now. Jeremiah 28:15, then Jeremiah the prophet said to Hananiah the prophet, okay, which one of them is a prophet? Both of them are. And what does Jeremiah the prophet say to Hananiah the prophet? Listen now, Hananiah, Adonai has not sent you, and you have made this people trust in a lie. False prophets are still prophets. False prophets promote falsehoods. But Jeremiah didn't say, you're no prophet. It says the prophet Jeremiah talked to the prophet Hananiah. And Hananiah was leading his people into lies. Ezekiel 13:2-6. Son of man, prophesy against the prophets of Israel who are prophesying, and say to those who prophesy from their own hearts, hear the word of Adonai. They have seen false visions and lying divinations. They say, declares Adonai, when Adonai has not sent them. And yet they expect him to fulfill their word. False prophets hope to force God's hand. So I'm going to prophesy this thing in God's name because I think it's something God really would want to do anyway. So I'm really going to do it, and I'm going to put myself out there, and I'm going to trust God to back me up on this one. And I think a lot of the well-meaning prophets out there talking today, this is their motivation. Like one guy who got on TV here a few months ago, and he prophesied that right now COVID's going to stop. It's erased from the world, and guess what? People still get it and still die from it. So much for him, huh? And then there's a guy who's had these dreams. I think he's a sincere guy, and this thing's been all over the internet, and I've had half a dozen people email me and talk to me. What do you think of these dreams this pastor has had? I don't think much of them. I just don't. And the dreams that he has, the only thing I can see them generate in anyone's life is fear. I find when God prophesies, there's a word of hope in there. There's a word of warning aligned with also a word of here's what you should do. This guy's warning was that everything's going to really go belly up here in November, so you should buy ammo and store food. I'm thinking, man, it doesn't sound like God to me. Somehow it just doesn't ring true. But false prophets hope to force God's hand. Matthew 7:15-20, beware of false prophets who come to you in sheep's clothing. They always look good. They look like one of us. But inwardly are ravenous wolves. Remember, sheep eat grass. Wolves eat sheep. And false prophets can often have very wicked motives. And what they want to do is they want to absorb you into themselves. They want you to look to them for guidance. And they want to have control of you. They want to draw you within. But Yeshua and true prophets, and I see the apostles do this, they don't want to draw you into themselves. They want to send you closer to God. He wants you to go and draw close to Him. No one comes to the Father but by me. So, you know, draw close, but I want you to go to the Father. But when a prophet wants you to become his disciple, there's a problem. Anyways, you will recognize them by their fruits, which means their lives. Are grapes gathered from thorn bushes or figs from thistles? So every healthy tree bears good fruit, but the diseased tree bears bad fruit. A healthy tree cannot bear bad fruit, nor can a diseased tree bear good fruit. Every tree that does not bear good fruit is cut down, thrown into the fire. Thus you will recognize them by their fruits. And so when someone claims to be a prophet or somebody on TV, first they want to know, what kind of life do they live when they're not on TV? What are their lives like? What are their marriages like? What do their kids think about them? And all you have to do is peek under the cover a little bit, and you can see the real kind of tree they are. You can see the real source. But anybody can look good for an hour on television or for an hour behind a pulpit. What kind of life do they live? And this is one of the wonderful things I love about Yeshua. He lived his life publicly. People saw them. His disciples walked with him. They talked about him. And his conversations, his life, his ways, how he lived, it was all an open book. He hid nothing. And so be very, very leery when someone really think, oh, they look like a prophet. Well, let's see what the roots are like. What are the fruits like? What is he really made of? True prophets produce good fruit. False prophets produce false fruit. Matthew 24:11 and 24. Many false prophets will arise and will mislead many. For false messiahs and false prophets will arise and will show great signs and wonders so as to mislead, if possible, even the elect. Signs and wonders are no proof of truth. Signs and wonders are no proof of truth. In fact, in Deuteronomy chapter 13, God speaks to Moses and says, tell the people of a prophet or a dreamer comes along and he prophesies, it comes true. He does signs and wonders that are genuine. But if he teaches you to walk away different from the way I'm teaching you, if he teaches you not to follow my commandments, he's a fraud. And I sent him to test you. Okay? So if somebody's working signs and wonders, think, okay, Lord, maybe this is a test. What's the guy teaching me to do? And then just a couple more. Acts 16. Now, this is very important. 16, verses 16 and 18. You need to read the whole chapter, but this little section is the crux. It happened that as we were going to the place of prayer, a slave girl having a spirit of divination met us, who was bringing her master much profit by fortune-telling. Following after Paul and us, she kept crying out, saying, these men are bondservants of the Most High God who are proclaiming to you the way of salvation. True, right? She continued doing this for many days, but Paul was greatly annoyed and turned and said to the Spirit, I command you in the name of Yeshua the Messiah to come out of her. And it came out at that very moment. So she was possessed of a demonic spirit. And she's following Luke and Paul and these men is saying, these men are bondservants of the Most High God. True. Who are proclaiming to you the way of salvation. True again. But there's one little fix you need to put in your translation. The word the way of salvation, the word the is not there in the Greek. So you put in the word a. We're proclaiming to you a way of salvation. Again, which is true, but it kind of hints that maybe there are many ways to be saved, and they're showing you one of them. So you really listen close to what's being said. This is probably why it took quite a while for Paul to finally realize there's something wrong. The message seems right, but the spirit is wrong. I've met people like that. The message is right, the spirit is wrong. I remember one time, I forget who it was I was talking to, it was back before I was married, but they were over, we were watching a TV show, we turned on one of these televangelists, one that you would all know the name. And they were saying something, oh man, what do you think? Is he a man of God? He just seems so sincere and everything, and his message is really captivating. And I did not like the guy that's on TV. And I got this idea. I said, let's do this. I turned the volume off so we could just see him. And I said, now what do you think of him? Because all you saw in his face was agony. It's almost a demonic face he had. His eyes were just fiery. And he looked like he was cursing almost in his facial expressions. He looked mad and angry and ticked off and like he hated you. And it's like when you looked in his eyes and you really saw the spirit that was behind the words. But sometimes a message is right or close to right, but the spirit's dead wrong. Even truth is not proof. And remember Balaam? He prophesied four times over the children of Israel. And everything he said was exactly true. Yet he was a fraud and a fake, and he was finally put to death for that wicked counsel he gave Balak. But his prophecies are right on the money. Here's our last one. 1 John 4:1. Beloved, do not believe every spirit. That's a commandment, by the way. Your first job number one, when you meet a prophet or someone gives you a word of knowledge, whatever, job one, don't believe it. But test the spirits to see whether they are from God, because many false prophets have gone out into the world. Prophets are a dime a dozen. So if someone tells you, I'm a prophet, say, oh, I have brown hair, or whatever. And here's the general rule to keep you safe. Don't believe any prophecies. Don't believe any of them. And 99 times out of 100, you're going to be on safe ground, solid ground. In fact, I'll change that. 999 times out of 1,000, you'll be right not to believe them. And the only prophet I ever met in my life who was really a prophet didn't come up to me and say, by the way, I'm a prophet. He didn't have to. He was proven through his words, through the things he knew, through the things God spoke through him, the things he spoke to me directly, too. Never once did he say, I'm a prophet, but it was obvious that he was. So my advice to you, don't listen to any prophet. Don't listen to any of them. And say, but Lord, if there is a real prophet who's speaking, awaken my heart to that. Alert my heart to that one. In the meantime, I'm not going to waste my time with all the fakes. Because prophets can lie. Prophets can prophesy on their own hope that God backs them up. They can prophesy on their own imaginations. They can prophesy because somebody's paying them to prophesy. They can prophesy because they don't like you. If they don't like you, you must not be someone who's aligned with their idea of God, and so they'll prophesy. There's all kinds of weird and strange and twisted reasons prophets can prophesy. Safe ground, just don't believe them. Just trust the Lord. Just trust his word. Okay? You hear what I'm saying? Am I saying anything out of balance? If Robin was here, she's teaching the kids, she'd be saying, she'd be doing and raising her hand and kind of bringing some correction. So, David, I'm going to let you take Robin's place this morning. Help me out.
Please don't let me take Robin's place. And forgive me if this is...
Nobody can.
I stepped out for a minute, so forgive me if this is not an appropriate question. But could you talk a little bit more about the idea of not trusting someone who wants to make disciples? Because I could imagine people who are called to be teachers and called to make disciples.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Who could get out of their job and get out of their work by saying, you know, I don't want to be perceived as wanting to make this. And I know you have taken people under your wing
before. Sure, of course.
Before. Yes. Could you just talk a little bit
more about that? Yes, yes, yes. See, thank you for channeling Robin this morning. But yes, we're to be making disciples, absolutely. But a false prophet wants you to become a disciple of them so they can control you, so they can their egos can be boosted by your following them, and they don't want you doing anything outside of what they want you to do. But what did Yeshua do? He discipled these apostles for 3 years. Then what did he do? He sent them. And if I make a disciple, or Steve or any of you are making disciples, it's so they can go out and do the work, not so we can just keep staying under us and feeding our ego and making us feel smart. It's that we want to serve you and equip you to do the work of God out there. We want to teach you to follow him, not stay stuck to us. It's like every parent raises a child so that child will never leave, or do they want to raise that child to be an adult and be able to live as a wise adult, a wise parent, a wise grandparent to future generations? That's the difference, okay? So I'm thank you for bringing that up, David. And we should probably get back to where we left off. So wherever that was, let's get back to that. Okay. Yes. All right. Back to Nehemiah now. Verse 15, chapter 6, verse 15. So the wall was finished on the 25th day of the month Elul. The 25th day of the month Elul. Did you know today is the first day of Elul? It just so happens. The first day of Elul. Elul is the sixth month in the biblical calendar. Next month is Tishrei. And the first day of Tishrei is called Yom HaTruah, or Rosh Hashanah, the Feast of Trumpets. And if you go to chapter 7 for a moment, just go to the very last verse, verse 73, I believe. It says, so the priests, the Levites, the gatekeepers, the singers, some of the people, the temple servants, and all Israel lived in their towns. And when the seventh month had come, the people of Israel were in their towns. And then it goes on down in the first couple of verses, next chapter, and they celebrate Rosh Hashanah, the Feast of Trumpets. So this is the sixth month, the month of Elul. And in the synagogues around the world, every day of this month, they will be sounding the shofar in the synagogue. They start sounding the shofar every day of Elul, and they read Psalm 27 every day. So you can read that at home. Then when Rosh Hashanah comes, that's the last trump. That's the last shofar. And they blow the shofar on Rosh Hashanah, the first day of Tishrei, on the Feast of Trumpets, and then that's when it ends. So keep that in mind when you hear read Paul talking about the last trump. Maybe he's referring to this preparatory time leading up to when the trumpet call comes, the ultimate trumpet call we all hear, the voice of Messiah. And but there are shofars being blown leading up to that. So just a thought. I don't know. I'm not saying that's the case. But sure is something to keep in mind. But I started wondering, why the 25th of Elul and why 52 days? Well, we mentioned before that this 52 is 2 times 26, and 26 is that unique number, the number of God's name, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. But I got out my calendar, my Jewish calendar, yesterday, and I counted back from 25th of Elul, I counted back 52 days. And guess what day it lands on? Tish B'Av, the 9th of Av. That's not coincidence. And if you know anything about Jewish history, you know that Solomon's temple was destroyed on the 9th of Av, almost 100 years earlier. And then if you go forward in time to 70 AD, Herod's temple, the temple that Yeshua taught at, it was also destroyed on the 9th of Av in 70 AD. Both temples were destroyed on the same day of the year. And so I think God's trying to say something to us here, that we all live at a time, a period between the time that God's house was on earth and a day when his house and his city would be on earth again. This 52 days is like a picture for all of us of where we live and what we should all be doing as living stones being built up into a house for God. They've built the temple, but build the walls of your life, build the gates of your life, install the doors of your life. And I asked you earlier, what was the thing that happened, and now we don't hear from Sanballat again, ever again in the whole book? They put the doors in the gates. We've talked the last few weeks about how you need to build walls around your life. Walls define who you are. If you have a wall around the kingdom, around a city, then what's outside the wall is not part of the city. What's inside the wall is. And when you build walls of your life, healthy, wholesome walls that beautify your life, then it's clear what is part of you and what is not. But without walls, you don't know where you end and where the culture begins, because it all kind of moozles together. It all just kind of flows in and out. And God says, there's no way to live. He wants us to be a disciple, so we have very clear-cut borders to our lives. But we have to have doors in our lives. Without a door, the walls become a prison. And those doors where things can go out from us and where things can come in to us. And remember, how many gates were there to the city? There were 10. 10 gates. And they each had a name. Your life also has 10 gates. You've got 5 physical ones: sight, hearing, smell, touch, taste. Right? And things come in. There's certain things you don't want in. If something tastes terrible or smells terrible or looks horrible, you want to close the gate and not look, not hear. But sometimes things are horrible and rotten, but they can look good, and you let them in. But you also have 5 spiritual gates. And I admit one of these previous weeks to go over these. I've gone over many times in the past, but time did not allow. But your discernment, that's a gate. Your communion with God is a gate. Your conscience is a gate. And you also have a couple of others, but we'll have to go over those another time. You've got 5 physical, you've got 5 spiritual. You are a soul. You've got 1 foot in the physical realm, 1 foot in the spiritual realm. And so there's input that comes. Some of it's healthy, some of it's very unhealthy, but we have to have gates. But until you put the doors up and the gates, anything can come in. And at each door, there had to be a guard to know when to open that gate, open that door, when to close it. And the moment you put the doors on the gates, and you've got wise guards, you've learned to exercise truth in your life and be disciplined, you know when to close your ears when something's coming in that is damaging, whether it's music or speech, to close your eyes, to put away from your eyes the things that are damaging to your soul, then Sanballat can attack. There's not much he can do. And the moment they put the doors on the gates, Sanballat's done with. He knows his goose has been properly and completely and thoroughly well done cooked. All right? You want to bring Satan's harassment in your life to as much of a close as you possibly can. Have good walls. Have good gates. Have good doors on them. And know when to open and know when to close. And that's what brings us to the next part. But I want to talk about this too. Elul. This is the Hebrew word Elul here. Aleph Lamed Vav Lamed. This month, as we prepare for the High Holy Days, Rosh Hashanah, then 10 days after that, Yom Kippur. 5 days after that, we've got Sukkot, the Feast of Tabernacles, which is the highlight of the year, the 7th feast, 7 days long, 7th month. But it kicks off with Elul. And the rabbis have known for many years that Elul is also an acronym for Ani Ladodi Vadodi Li. Aleph Lamed Vav Lamed. I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine. That's the theme of this month. Somebody loves me and I belong to him. And he's loved me so much he's given himself to me. I belong to him. He belongs to me. That's the message of this month. As we prepare to meet him during the days of Rosh Hashanah, those 10 days of all, 10 days of prayer and repentance, and then Yom Kippur, we stand before him as our judge. And the Feast of Sukkot, where we celebrate the fruit, all the good fruit he's brought into our lives. And we take 7 days just to celebrate all he's done for us. But leading up to that is this awareness. So whenever you think of this month, every day, Elul, Ani Ladodi, Vadodi Li. I am my beloved's, my beloved is mine. That's the theme. Okay, let's go on a bit further. Now, in chapter 7, It says, now when the wall had been built and I had set up the doors and the gatekeepers, the singers and the Levites had been appointed, I gave my brother Hanani and Kananiah, the governor of the fortress or the citadel, charge over Jerusalem. For he was more faithful and God-fearing man than many. I love that phrase, a faithful man and feared God or God-fearing. I want us to take a look at that phrase in the red letters. This is what it looks like in Hebrew. There's something very important here that God's emphasized. You know, Hebrew is an extraterrestrial language. It's the tongue of angels that Paul referred to. It's not of this earth. It's the language of transcendence. And every jot and every tittle of this language was set in place by God himself. So I want us to learn something from this. So, a faithful man, it's Ka'ish Emet. And then it says, and he feared the Yare God at Ha'Elohim. Now, I put some letters in gray. And these are letters that are prefixed to words because prepositions are not used in Hebrew very much. Prepositions take a form of a letter you just attach to the front. And this kaf here is attached to the word ish. Ish means man. So it means he was like an ish or what a man, okay? But the word there is ish. And then when you see the word ish, you know the kaf, it means it's like he was as a man or just the epitome of a man of truth, a man of emet. There's no word for and in Hebrew. They just stick a letter vav on the front of a word to mean and. Vav means hook. And that's how you hook one word to another. You put a hook in front. But it's not part of the word so much. Yare means fears. And then et is not translated. Aleph Tav, first and last letters of the alphabet. It's a pointer word that points to the direct object of the sentence. So whatever comes after et, whatever comes after this word, that is the direct object of the sentence. Everything's pointing to that. So what did he fear? Et. Ha-Elohim, and there's the word for the. You put a hey in front of a word, it means the. So you've got five words, but you have these letters stuck onto the front, but they're not part of the actual root of what the word is saying. So here are the five words. Ish, whoops, sorry about that. Ish is man. Emet is truth. And here, and many translations translate truth as faithfulness, feareds, and then we don't translate the Aleph Tav, Elohim, or God. There are five words. Notice anything interesting about those five words? Now we've stripped them of the extraneous little prepositional prefixes. What do you notice about them? Four of them start with Aleph. Aleph, the first letter of the alphabet. The letter, it's called the Lord and Master of the alphabet. The letter that always represents God. Numerical value of one, but it's a silent letter. It speaks through the other letters. And the name, the word Aleph means master. And when you see an Aleph, it usually is a pointer to God himself. Each word begins with God, except for this one, the word fear. Here we see Aleph at the very end of the word. Fear always moves God to the back. When you have fear in your life, God moves to the end. Because the thing you're afraid of becomes your God. He's the one who controls you now. But what happens if you take Yare and reverse the spelling? What does it become now? Ari, lion. Turn your Yare into an Ari. Ari, good name for a boy. Hope one of our ladies are expecting to have a boy, they name him Ari. What a great name, Lion. R-E-L, Lion of God. What an amazing name, great name. But when you take your fear and you conquer it, you turn it around, you put Aleph back at the front where it belongs, it becomes a lion. Right? See why I get so excited about Hebrew? It's kind of an amazing language, isn't it? Well, let's quickly finish up. Verse 3 seems kind of strange, but hopefully we'll understand it here and then we'll close. I said to them, let not the gates of Jerusalem be opened until the sun is hot. And while they are still standing guard, let them shut and bar the doors. What in the world does that mean? Well, let me show you, give you a little archaeology lesson. This is Tel Megiddo. And in our trip to Israel a couple of years ago, we went here. It's a very, very ancient city. And when you come to Tel Megiddo, you come up this pathway right here. Okay, you walk up this path, and then the gates of the city are pretty amazing, massive gates, what's left of them. And then, after that, there's this open area. You have this large open area, but you can't get into the city from there because there's a second set of gates. So when you come into this area right here, that's where the merchants would come in, sell their goods. This is where strangers would come in and trade news or whatever, but they weren't considered in the city yet. To go into the city, they had to go in through an extra set of gates. Now, here is a photograph of the sign that's there at the entrance to the ruins of Megiddo. And you see this area here? This is like the court area where people come and set up their stands. They would trade, they would talk, and some guys would just come and visit here, do their business, and then leave. But if you wanted to go into the city, you had to go through these gates over here. And they didn't just let anybody come in there. They'd say, where are you from? Who do you know here? What's your business here? When you come in, where are you staying? How long are you staying? And then they might check with the person you claim to be staying with. You know this guy? They were so careful about who they let into the main gates. And so when Nehemiah says, I said to them, let not the gates of Jerusalem be open until the sun is hot. He's talking about these main gates up here. They can come in here down at the bottom. They can mill around, trade their merchandise, gossip, whatever they want to do. But this stays barred till the middle of the day. And then it says, and while they're still standing guard, let them shut and bar the doors. Okay? So once these people have left, we're going to bar the doors here. And then we'll let these people come in one at a time, providing we know who they are. Apply this to your own life. If somebody shouts an obscenity or flashes a picture in your face or a billboard, it's already in. It's already come in. But now you get to decide if it gets to come in to live, if it comes in to stay. It's in this courtyard you take a thought captive. And then you decide if you're going to let it nest in your brain or dispel it. Say, no, I'm not going to ponder on that and meditate on that anymore. We always have things coming to knock at the doors and we have to kind of interview in our lives. But you get to decide, does it come on in all the way and get to make a home there? Does it get to spend the night there? Does it get to live there for a time? You understand? If you want to keep Sanballat, you want to keep the enemy out of your life, have good doors on your gates. Have guards, wisdom guarding those gates. Have strong walls that define who you are. Got it? We're in a war zone. We don't have to be fearful. Now we've constructed our walls, our doors, and our gates, and are guarding them with wisdom, there's nothing to fear. Many people that are discussed in these chapters lived outside the walls, but if there was danger, they'd run into the walls. They'd run inside. The farmers, they stayed out there, they did their thing. But the safety was within the walls. They were considered citizens of that city, even if their house was not inside the walls. And so there are people outside who are depending on the walls to be good, depending on the doors to hold fast. There are people depending on us to be strong for them. There will always be people running to become a part of who we are and what we do. So make sure you define who you are. You've got good walls, good gates, good doors, and wisdom. And Tim, I see your hand up, so go right ahead. If there's a microphone, and then over to David here. And then if we run over time, you blame these two guys. How's that? That works for me. Okay, Tim.
So this is the area where merchants would be. And we know that in so many other passages that the gates were a prominent place for very important things to take place, judgments, you know, all that kind of stuff. Where would that be in this drawing? Would that be still within the city, or would that be close to outside, or what? Just to complete the picture of how we're, if the city is ourselves, our soul, and this okay. place is where we keep captive thoughts captive.
Are you talking about like physically how this compares?
Yeah, physically.
The rest
how
of the city?
How what would be the process physically, so we can understand spiritually how things work to come in and out of us?
Well, people who are citizens, good question. People who are citizens of the city would come out the door to mingle and do business with the people coming to bring their merchandise to the city. You go to work. You step out your home. You go past that mezuzah, which means inside my house, this is God's kingdom. God's rules here. But now I'm going out of the house. I'm going out into territory that's not mine. I'm coming out the gates to mingle with coworkers, with neighbors, with whatnot. Because I have to conduct my business. I have to do something for a living. But then I come back home. I come back here. This is where I live. This is where I work, and here's where I live. And you want to make sure when you come back home, you're not bringing something in with you that's going to pollute that home. And this is why that mezuzah is always there right on the gate, on the right-hand side. You know, the tendency, you touch it, you kiss it, that's tradition. That's to remember, first of all, that's put where the bondservant's ear was put. They put an awl through his ear into the door. That's where a blood spot would be in ancient times. It means, God, I belong to you. As I come back home, I come back into your kingdom. I can leave behind me all the stuff of the world, the nonsense I heard. But Lord, as I come into here, I'm coming into your domain. And I'm your bondservant. I belong to you. And inside that little mezuzah is a scroll, Deuteronomy 6:4 to, I think, like verse 10. Hear, O Israel. No, obey. Hear. It's my ear. Hear, O Israel, Lord our God, the Lord is one. Blessed is the name of his glorious kingdom forever and ever. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength. And these words I command you today shall be on your hearts. Right? And you go on through and remember, you teach them to your children when you walk away, when you lie down, and when you rise up, and you write them on the doorposts of your homes and on your gates. It's a reminder, I'm going back to a place of safety, a place where God's rules apply. So that courtyard to me represents the world. And it's kind of small. But the big area is through the doors in my home. That's enormous. This is an eternal place. This is a heavenly place. This is a place where God dwells, right? So that needs to be our attitude. If that was our attitude, I think our marriages are... our parenting, our families, our homes, everything about our existence would be much better. And if you're married to a woman of valor, she invests in the home. She makes it a place you can't wait to get back to. And, so all these dynamics work together. But we are like a city, each one of us. It's extremely complicated. And we need to realize that. And if we realize to look at ourselves as the scripture describes a city, then we're going to be better equipped to do what we need to do in this life. All right? So I don't know if that's probably a lot more answer than you wanted, or a completely different answer than you wanted. But anyways, you get what you pay for. This is free. Okay, and then David will let you have the last word.
So the farmers, you know, the enemy is coming in, and these farmers are obviously supplying the city. Yeah. They need the protection. They run in. I mean, do they go beyond those outer gates and into the inner gates?
I would imagine so, because they're well known. They're bringing their food to the city. The people inside, depending on these farmers for what they do.
Okay.
Yeah.
So does that at all incorporate into how we go out of ourselves and into the world? And
I'm going to let you figure that one out. Because you're asking some very good questions, and the questions I think we're supposed to ask. But that's what the beauty of God's word is. We're always thinking, okay, what does this mean, and how do I apply it to myself? And it's, yeah. So I'm going to let you just figure that out. Get back with me when you do. All right. Okay, I'm sure there are other questions, but we've really run over. And thank you for listening, for your patience. We're going to close in prayer, and I just have a few quick announcements. So let's pray. Our Father and King, thank you. Thank you so much for being such a wonderful and good God and Redeemer to us. Lord, set us free from fear. Give us such an appetite for truth and for courage and for freedom that nothing ever again will make us afraid, because we realize that you run the world and you do so perfectly. Thank you for loving us so well. Thank you for your word that's a lamp to our feet, a light to our path, the word of truth, our sword of the Spirit. So help us to dress in our armor every day as we go out into the world and encounter things that would harm us if they could. And we'll give you the praise and glory for our victories. In Yeshua's name, amen.